May it please the Court. Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors. My name is Chase Brockstead, and seated at council table is my colleague, Jeff Gianellotti. And together, we represent the appellants, Rodney and Diane McDougall. This is a garden variety negligence case, and there are four elements: duty, breach, proximate cause, and damages. With regard to duty, the court below ruled that Mahaffey and Schneider, the two defendants in this case, owed a duty to Rodney McDougall. That duty arose from their joint negligent design of the electrical system at DHCI. It did not arise from any contract. Simply, they had the obligation to fix their error. This issue has been decided, and it is the law of the case. Moving forward in the analysis to the fourth element,
well,
damages.
What's been decided? That there was a breach of contract, or that there was a duty which arose from the joint negligent design?
The latter, Your Honor, that there was a duty which arose from the joint negligent design.
Is that a contractual duty?
No, it is not. That is a duty that simply arises from their negligence.
Well, as I understand it, what the court held was that if there is a duty here, a tort duty, it's a duty to exercise due care in carrying out the other duties that are imposed independently by the contract. And then the court proceeded to analyze the contract and found that the contract itself, or contracts, because we're talking about two co-defendants here, did not impose any duty. And that duty could not be created by expert testimony, as it were, out of thin air. Unless I have that wrong, that seems to be sort of the global framework in which we're directed to analyze this case. Is that correct?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor.
Which part do you disagree
with? Well, let's sort of take it step by step. And if we're going to be talking about duty, I just want to make sure that we're clear with where we are. The court ruled, and I'm going to quote, because of the negligent design by incorporating Schneider's work product, there was a duty created upon Mahaffey to coordinate and direct the breaker replacement. This much the court agrees with. Mahaffey was required to fix its error. Beyond that, the court talked about Schneider and it having a duty, and it also replacing the breaker and discharging its duty. We believe that the duty arose not from the contract, but from the negligent design. Moving to the next step, which is what was required and whether the defendants discharged those duties, that's issues of fact that are outside of the contract. And I want to make sure I'm just answering your question, Your Honor.
Okay. You're saying that at least as to one of the defendants that had some design contractual obligation, the breach of the duty was to design it improperly. Is that what you're saying?
Both defendants breached their duty.
They didn't both have a duty to design the breaker, did they?
Yes. In fact, the
Well, yes. Where in the brief, where in the contract does it say that?
Well, Schneider was contracted to create a coordination study. That coordination study, which is essentially a design of the electrical system, was a joint effort between Schneider and Mahaffey.
There's a difference between a coordination effort, which, you know, can involve coordinating anything, post-design, and a design. And we're trying to be very precise here. Which party, if any, had designed the system, including the faulty breaker, here?
Both. We're not talking about coordinating something. We're talking about a specific map of the electrical system, which is called a short circuit coordination study. And essentially what this is an on-paper design of the electrical system. The creation of that study was a joint effort between Mahaffey and Schneider. The study, the coordination system, the map of DHCI, of the electrical system, was designed negligently.
Did they both have equal responsibility from a legal standpoint in the design of the system?
Yes. And in fact, the
Based on what?
Well, based on the facts of the case. And also based on the contract, the way that the contracts read was that Schneider was required to author the study and then submit drafts to Mahaffey for its review.
Okay, so your, and I'll stop at this point, your view of the matter is that the contract imposed a duty to design, and I gather implicit in that is properly design, the system, including the breaker that was at fault, and that wasn't done. And that disposes of the duty issue. Is that fair?
That's correct. Okay, the lower court found that there was a duty owed.
Okay, then the issue then becomes one of proximate cause.
Well, the issue is whether there's been a breach of that duty. And
the issue becomes one of proximate cause, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay.
Well, to whom is that duty owed?
Well, the duty to provide a working, upgraded electrical system at DHCI, that duty was owed by Mahaffey and Schneider to the state. That was the contract between Mahaffey with the state of Delaware to provide a working electrical system. The negligence did not satisfy that obligation because when the system was started up, the breaker that was being changed on June 14, 2008 would nuisance trip. And the reason why Mr. McDougal was there that day was to replace that breaker.
Well, what's the remedy for this breach? Does it necessarily require that they undertake an effort to fix it? Or could they say, we're done, send us a bill for our breach?
Well, they undertook the responsibility to fix it.
Okay, so that does not mean then that they have to fix it, though, does it?
No, but if they undertake the responsibility to fix it, they have to do that reasonably. And I would submit to you, Your Honor, that what is reasonable, once you get past the duty, which again we believe is the law of the case, that Mahaffey and Schneider had a duty to do something. What that was, what they were required to do, and whether their actions were reasonable are issues of fact. And we believe that it was improper for the court to rule that the simple act of Mahaffey sending an email to Tudor Electric directing them to replace the breaker and Schneider agreeing to pay for the replacement breaker was improper for the court to rule that those actions satisfied their duties. Again, that's an issue of fact.
Well, don't you have precedent on the other side of that issue you have to overcome where the courts have said in Delaware that whether or not there's a legal duty is a question of law for the court to decide?
There's no question, and I completely agree with that precedent. The duty to act, we agree, is an issue of law, and we agree that the court has found that both Mahaffey and Schneider had a duty to act. But now what we're talking about is something different than...
Let's set aside what the court said. I understand your law of the case argument. Other than that statement, where is the legal source for the duty? What precedent do you rely upon as the source of this duty?
The argument that we were making to the lower court prior to this decision was that there was a duty owed by Mahaffey and Schneider to replace the breaker or at least coordinate the effort to replace the breaker. Okay? The court agreed that the negligent design conferred a duty or imposed a duty.
I keep saying that. Set aside what the court said because we may or may not agree with that. So in terms of there being a tort duty of care. So what is the case law or the restatement or anything else that you rely upon prior to the court's statement that supports your position?
If I could, Your Honor, I'd like to refer to my brief.
Or is it a novel position that the court took for the first time? I mean, that can be your position as well. I just want to know what it is.
Your Honor, I think it's, and I was just looking at our Supreme Court brief. I know that this was briefed at the lower court below. But essentially, the argument that we were making to Judge Graves at the time was that when Mahaffey and Schneider designed the electrical system, they had the contractual obligation to assign it, design it in such a way that it was properly functioning.
Okay?
And so the fact that they did not do it that way, the fact that their design was negligent and it caused this nuisance tripping, our arguments below, and I cannot put my finger on the citations that we submitted at that point in time, but our arguments were that error that imposed a duty upon them to fix that error. And again, I don't have the lower court brief in front of me right now, but those were arguments that we made to Judge Graves, and they were accepted. And the court below found, and the law of the case is, that there was this duty, and the duty.
Well, the duty was owed to the hospital, correct? I mean, that was the owner of the facility. That duty was fulfilled. Either Mahaffey or Schneider both agreed that the defective or deficient breaker would be replaced. So we're beyond that. The real question is there a duty to the employee of an independent contractor who was tasked with replacing the breaker?
Well, the duty was to fix the error. Okay, that's what the court held. The duty was that Mahaffey and Schneider had to fix the error.
Okay, but okay? We're beyond that. That was in the contract, or at least everybody viewed it that way. And both of the defendants said, yes, you're right, we'll fix the error. And then they pointed to independent contractor who happens to be the plaintiff's employer and said, fix it. Now, where's the duty? What is the source of the duty, as Justice Ridgely asked, owed to the employee of the independent contractor who had otherwise no relationship at all to either of the defendants?
Well, the duty is to act reasonably. Okay, and so when you're assigning the work and you're putting someone into this type of environment, an electrical environment with high voltage, with an electrical system that took a year to design and 2 years to install, you have the duty of care to act.
Let's cut through this. You know, there was a finding by the court, and the evidence showed that the safety procedures that anyone versed in this trade, as the plaintiff was, that were needed to be undertaken in order to replace the breaker were not properly put into place. And that was the fault of the plaintiff and an independent supervening cause that negated any proximate cause, even if there was a duty.
Well, Your Honor, so talking about causation, what the court ruled as a matter of law was that Mr. McDougall's conduct on June 14 was the sole proximate cause of his injuries. We believe that to be an error. And the reason is to make that finding as a matter of law, particularly at the summary judgment stage, was that the court had to determine that no reasonable minds could differ as to whether or not Mr. McDougall's conduct was unforeseeable.
Well, what facts, what you're saying is there should have been a trial. What material facts would a trial unearth?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is there were genuine issues of material fact which precluded summary judgment.
And what facts were genuinely material?
Well, with regard to foreseeability, we would submit, Your Honor, that the factual record shows that Mr. McDougall was not qualified pursuant to NFPA 70E to perform this. It required training on the exact specific equipment, brand new equipment installed at DHCI, not similar equipment on some other site. It involved specific training on the specific methods that he was being asked to do that day.
You argued that to the court?
Well, we didn't have the benefit of oral argument, Your Honor, but we did in our briefing.
And the court rejected that?
It did, Your Honor. And it also rejected expert testimony, not only from our expert, but I think that the best evidence in this case that Mr. McDougall did not appreciate or understand the risk and the hazards he confronted on June 14 come from the defendant's experts. The defendant's experts have testified that Mr. McDougall simply didn't know what he didn't know, and Schneider's expert in particular opined and testified that Mr. McDougall was not qualified and incapable of understanding the risk of harm that he confronted that day and was unable to guard against it. And I see my time is for sum up. I reserve 6 minutes for the end.
Well, we'll reserve the time you have left. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Cottrell from the firm of Ty and Cottrell. I'm here representing the engineer in this case, half the associates. First, this is a worker injury case. It's a standard worker injury case governed by American Institute of Architects standard form contracts. It's an issue that's been reviewed by many, many states. It's black letter law that when you have the duties defined so carefully by these standard form contracts, which as we point out are even used by the state of Delaware, so they're de facto standards that clearly define the duties, and this is simply a run-of-the-mill worker injury case with admittedly horrendous injuries to the plaintiff. The AIA provisions state clearly that the design engineer has no responsibility for worker safety at the site and no responsibility for the means and methods that the contractor carries out in doing that work at the site. I beg to differ with the judge below in stating that the coordination study was defective. In fact, the coordination study, which was a submittal by the contractor to the design professional to review, it showed the details of how they were going to do the work or what they were going to put in the field.
So before you leave this thought, does it follow from what you just told us that if anyone had responsibility for the safety of the worker, in this case the plaintiff, it would be his employer?
That is,
and that would include training this worker to in the necessary safety procedures, if any training was needed.
That is absolutely correct, and Mr. Tudor, the principal of plaintiff's employer, testified that there had been training, and the plaintiff was indeed a master electrician.
So you would be arguing, I gather, that if there was any fact issue about the training of the plaintiff and whether he knew what the proper safety procedure was, that's not a material issue because it goes to the liability of the employer, and that's subsumed by the workers' compensation exclusivity provision.
Exactly correct, Your Honor. That's why it's replete. If you look at the contract documents, not only the contract between the state and the engineer, which was the B-151, it says, again, we're not responsible for worker safety. We're not responsible for their means and methods. Again, it's stated in the A-201 general conditions, which is part of the contractor's contract. So it's echoed and repeated and duplicated so that everyone understands clearly what their responsibilities are. The coordination study in and of itself gave the right information and was reviewed and approved by the engineer. It was in the field that the transformer there did not have the performance requirements stated in the coordination study. It was in conflict with the breaker.
Does it matter?
It doesn't. But just so the my view of the facts here, because
I mean, even if there was a faulty design, does it matter?
No, it does not. Because if you take plaintiff's theory about duty, every worker at every site is there because they have to implement the design. So in one sense, they're there because of the design.
What was the source of the obligation to actually replace the breaker? Or was that essentially, we'll volunteer to keep good relations with the contractor, contacting parties, and therefore we'll fix that as opposed to writing you a check to get somebody else to do it?
No, and again, Mr. Tudor admitted that this was part of their responsibility to replace. It was actually the transformer that was wrong, but it was decided it's a lot cheaper and easier just to switch the breaker. So that's what they decided to do.
Is there some form of warranty or something of the work?
It is. It's non-conforming work, if I may. At paragraph 4.2.6 of these general conditions, which appears at page B359 of our appendix, quote, the architect, meaning the engineer, will have authority to reject work that does not conform to the contract documents. And that's what the situation was. the transformer in the field didn't match with that breaker, they had to fix this nonconforming work. The engineer exercises responsibility. And here again, quote, however, neither this authority of the architect nor a decision made in good faith either to exercise or not to exercise such authority shall give rise to a duty or responsibility of the architect to the contractor, subs, material and equipment suppliers, their agents, or employees, or other persons or entities performing the work.
So whatever duty there was based on contract.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's where I think you always have to look first and foremost in a situation like this, where, again, the parties have carefully negotiated what their duties will be and are using standard form contracts that, as I say, have been sanctioned by the state. This was a state of Delaware project. So they reviewed the submittals. It was approved because internally that coordination study was correct, the numbers given. Then during construction in the field with this tripping that was mentioned, they discover there's nonconforming work. The engineer exercised his duty to order the contractor to correct the nonconforming work. Tudor admits that that's what was happening here, and that, in fact, was done. So in fact, in the briefs, you'll note that Snyder actually did not charge for this breaker. I think it was $6,000 or $8,000 involved, because Snyder is part of the contractor's side of these contracts. Tudor had the main contract with the state. It then subcontracted with Graybar for certain equipment to be supplied.
Does that, any of that matter?
It doesn't, but I just want to explain who the parties were and how this was a normal delivery system for a construction project, and where you look to the contractor's side to correct nonconforming work. And as I say, as further evidence of that, Snyder did not try to get an extra for supplying this further breaker. They recognized
even if he did, would it matter?
I don't think so. But it,
then,
it
then what are we talking about it?
I'm talking about the fact this was nonconforming work that the engineer could reject and order the contractor to replace. And again, it's repeated that how that's done, the means and methods and safety precautions at site, are strictly the contractor's bailiwick.
Meaning Tudor?
Correct, sir.
There was a suggestion in Mr. Brockstedt's comments that obligation to train those who were working on the circuit breaker existed. Did that exist by contract? And if it did, who had that responsibility?
That responsibility was on the contractor side. There is, as is usual in a lot of these construction projects, the obligation of the manufacturer to have some on-site training, and that's primarily for the benefit of the state employees that are then going to have to maintain this equipment as it goes into operation. And that was done. Those sessions were held. The plaintiff was at some of those sessions. We weren't. Again, that's contractor performing obligations under their contract.
And the contractor with the training obligation was which contractor?
Well, that would again fall into Tudor to make sure that was done.
So there's no obligation on the part of the manufacturer or designer of the circuit breaker to give any training to the employees who would be installing it on how it was to be installed. Is that what you're telling us?
That is correct. This is, again, as a master electrician. He testified he was familiar with the lockout process. There's some dispute in the record about whether he was familiar with this particular type of equipment. But again, the record is replete with, if you don't know this particular equipment or what you're doing, then you stop and call somebody and ask some questions. Again, that's the means and methods of construction at site and safety precautions at site. Because this was a master electrician who had been trained, there is part of the contract documents that the contractor must make sure there's some training sessions for state employees that would then maintain the equipment thereafter. And as I say, some Tudor employees.
I sort of got lost after the yes to the Chief Justice's answer. I gather what you're telling us is, number one, if any party had a duty to train the injured plaintiff, it was Tudor, the employer. Two, if there was a breach of that duty, the redress for that breach is encompassed in the workers' compensation system, not in the common law tort area. And three, as a consequence, there was no duty and therefore no liability as far as Mahaffey and Snyder were concerned.
That is absolutely correct, and I thank Your Honor for stating it much better than I did.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carl Scherf, Pro Hack PG, on behalf of Schneider Electric. I apologize yet again, and I am sorry. Unfamiliarity made me a little nervous, and I'm quite nervous now. I'd like to begin with addressing what the Chief Justice raised, which is the circuit breaker. The plaintiff's testimony was that the circuit breaker was not the issue. The issue was the transfer switch, which is not Schneider equipment. It's equipment supplied by an entity known as Cummins, which settled out of this case. He did go to a training session from Cummins where the method of lockout was not addressed, but that's not before this court at this time. He had locked out similar transfer switches in the past. That's reflected in the court's decision below. It's also reflected in his testimony.
Just one quick interruption, just factually. The transfer switch is not a part of the breaker that was being replaced?
The plaintiff's expert says it is, but there is actually a separate transfer switch, which is in an entirely separate room.
Okay.
And the testimony is all about the transfer switch. It's a transfer
switch. And the function of the transfer switch was to shut off the power, correct?
When power is going to be locked out to the area, when you shut off the utility side, because it's a hospital, there's an emergency generator. The emergency generator sits on a timer. That's exactly what happened to him. Because the power wasn't turned off, it timed out, or timed in, depending on how you want to look at it, and the power went on. If it had been locked out, meaning you remove the breakers and rack them out so that electricity cannot physically flow, which is what the standards require, he could never have been hurt. That's his testimony. That's the expert's testimony. So there's no mystery about it. He knew how to rack out a transfer switch. There's no proof that there was anybody at that scene who didn't know how to rack out a transfer switch. There's a letter written by Tudor after the fact that indicates some issue about it, but none of the people who were there have so testified. And plaintiff testified very clearly that he knew how to rack out a transfer switch. It's not.
So one of your points conceptually, tell me if I've got it right or wrong, is that there is no connection, legal or factual, between the design
Correct.
Of the breaker and the way this accident took place.
Correct. This is a problem with the means and methods that were selected by the plaintiff, by the fellows from DHCI who were involved, one of whom was a master electrician and one of whom was a journeyman who expressly testified, I knew how to rack it out. I was surprised they didn't do it. So it's a means and methods question. He didn't get hurt because he was there. He got hurt because the methods selected were inadequate. Those were methods that Schneider didn't know about, had no reason to foresee, no duty to foresee, because Schneider had no relationship to them. It's a pure nonfeasance argument. You have to have a duty to have nonfeasance claims. The only person who says there's a duty is their expert. Their expert was found not to be qualified on questions of duty, and that his opinions were contrary to the record, an opinion that was not appealed, by the way, or a decision that was not appealed. So that's the case as to duty. That's the case as to causation. The plaintiff's own expert concedes that there's no foreseeability here. He says that he himself, even knowing what happened, cannot believe that somebody would go back there without locking out. So it's objectively unforeseeable. And the expert's been precluded and hasn't been appealed. That is the entirety of our position. And if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The arguments with respect to breach and with causation, I think, are spelled out adequately, sufficiently in our briefs. So I'm going to focus a little bit on duty. Mr. Cottrell talked about the fact that these contracts and the contract work that was happening were carefully negotiated. The work that was assigned to Tudor to replace the breaker was not contract work. and in our briefs and also in some of the supporting documents, is the fact that substantial completion had already occurred. And let's talk about that for a second. The work that the state of Delaware was asking Mahaffey, Schneider, Tudor, everyone to do was sent out to bid. The Tudor had the opportunity to, number one, look at what the work it was being asked to do to assess whether or not it had the expertise, the qualifications, the training, and the manpower to do that work. They determined that they could do that work, and they submitted a cost for that work to be done. That bid was accepted on January 30 of 2006.
Well, aren't the defendants entitled to rely on that representation from Tudor? We can do the work?
Yes. Tudor's contract work was substantially completed on January 1st, 2008. As of January 1st, 2008, when certificates of substantial completion were accepted by the state of Mahaffey and when Tudor's warranty began to run, the work that they had performed had been accepted. The contract work, which they bargained for, which they represented that they could do, had been accepted by the state. 4 months later, this nuisance tripping was identified. Tudor's contract did not require them, nor did they bargain for the obligation to repair design defects from other parties. All right? There was no change directive here to any existing contract.
Let's assume all that's true. What's the significance of it?
The significance of that is that completely severs the contract. This was new work that was substantially much different. Tudor was being asked by essentially a superior, someone that it derives much economic benefit from contractually, to fix an error.
Okay,
they didn't have the opportunity to assess whether or not it or its employees had the required expertise, training, and specific qualifications required under the NFPA to do this work.
Okay, so your point, I gather, is that because this work was, the contract was no longer enforced, then the contract no longer sets the boundaries of the duties, if any, that Schneider and or Mahaffey had.
Right.
Therefore, those duties can be filled, I guess, like helium in a balloon by the common law of torts. And if there is no legal source for it, then an expert can get up and testify that there was a duty, and that automatically generates a right to a trial. Is that your point?
No, the duty was found by the lower court, and that determination has not been appealed.
The duty was found by the lower court within the framework of the contract.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I think the plain language of the decision is that because of the negligent design, the defendants had the duty to fix their error. Your Honor, I would disagree that the court found that this was a contractual duty to do something. This was a duty that arose directly from their negligence. And with regard to the means and methods.
What is the tort rule then, that anytime someone breaches a contract or commits negligence, they have a duty to remediate the harm?
Well, not to remediate the harm, but, I mean, Mahaffey and Schneider had a duty to fix their error. They were to provide to the state a working, upgraded, brand new electrical system.
They couldn't write them a check.
I don't know if their contract would have allowed them to write a check, but they didn't. What they did was they sent an email to a subcontractor and said, hey, fix this problem. Fix this error in an inrush calculation that they all handled in the coordination study, in the actual mapping of the electrical system. And they said, hey, fix this error. And that was all that they did. And what the court said below was that they had the duty to fix that error. And then the question is whether or not they acted reasonably in discharging that duty. That's an issue of fact that we believe is within the province of the jury.
In asserting that there was a duty that arose out of the original contractual relationship, did the court address whether the accusation of the breach of that duty was misfeasance or nonfeasance and the scope of the duty?
It did not, Your Honor. We're left with the language of the opinion itself.
Well, what's your view of the scope of the duty? How far does it reach?
And when you're talking about the duty, you're talking about the duty imposed upon Mahaffey and Schneider?
I'm assuming, for the sake of argument, that outside the contract, the designer and the subcontractor manufacturer had two choices, an efficient breach or fix the contract because of continuing goodwill and relationships, a business decision that people make every day. You either pay for the cost of the breach or you fix it so there's no longer a breach. They chose the latter. Now, when they do that, your accusation is that they did so negligently and that that negligence somehow proximately caused the injuries to your client. Where does the duty extend under these circumstances beyond a duty to carefully install a functioning product that arose out of the original contract?
The duty imposed upon Mahaffey and Schneider was the duty to act reasonably. The court found...
I get that, but that duty to act reasonably stops at some logical point. It doesn't extend to the world for all purposes. That's particularly true in a nonfeasance case.
Sure.
But to tell me how it extends to the worker here.
Well, I would submit to you that when Mahaffey and the state hired Tudor, when they accepted their bid, okay, there was representations made that they could do certain work. Okay, so I would argue that with regard to the completion of that work, Mahaffey had satisfied its duty to the state that they've got a capable contractor. With regard to the replacement of this breaker, they had the same duty. Before that, they were going to direct someone to replace the breaker. They had the duty, since this was their error, their problem, they had a duty to make sure that who they were signing that work to was qualified to perform that work.
So this is a negligent hiring case.
Your Honor, I would submit to you that this is a case that is the assignment of the work to replace the breaker, okay? They did not fulfill their duty and act reasonably. What they were required to do and whether they did it, that's an issue of fact.
Okay. All right, I think we understand the parties' respective position. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Right.